The order of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. Colleagues, today is April 13th, and we're convened for the purposes of an informational meeting, primarily to report on House Bill 3194, and we have a number of district attorneys and Mike Schmidt from the Criminal Justice Commission, who will be also reporting. Mr. Rocco, anything you want to tee up for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to note that this material, there's quite a bit of material that was provided by district attorneys and Mr. Schmidt, and it's all been posted on OLIS. I think we did that on last Wednesday, so that people have a chance to look it over before the meeting. And so the order of the material on OLIS will follow the agenda, and then additional materials that were submitted by district attorneys are also included after the people that are going to present today.
All right. Mr. Schmidt, lead us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Public Safety Subcommittee. My name is Mike Schmidt. I am the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. I've been asked to come here today and report to you on how House Bill 3194 and its implementation, the prison has actually been used, how it's been shifting since the implementation of this bill. I have prepared a very extensive and long presentation, but I only intend to go through about the first 20 slides, because after that, you essentially have the exact same information, but I broke it down county by county so that you can look into whatever county is of interest of you to do some more investigation. So with that, I will get started. This is a map of the state of Oregon. Obviously, we've broken it up. The CJC's broken it up into four different sections, and these different sections correspond roughly with prison usage. The white area, we're calling the metro region, uses about 62% of all prison resources in the state of Oregon. We then regionally split up the state into three other regions so that we could talk together.
Just a moment, Representative Krieger.
But you said 62%, which is the white area. What's the population of that? Is that 62% or is it more?
I have not done that analysis, Rep. Krieger, but I can figure that out pretty quick for you and get that back to you. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what we've done is we've kind of put the state in these four regions so that we could go out and have meetings with the counties and talk to them about how they're using their prison, what the resources look like, and so that they could have conversations around the table about what they're seeing in their communities. So from a statewide level, moving on to the next slide, just starting off, I put three slides in here that show you kind of that same 62%. You can see the prison usage by county across every county, from Multnomah uses the most all the way down to Wheeler with zero in the last year. Another way to look at that is this pie chart. The five largest counties, again, use that 61 to 62%. And if you're interested specifically in prison intakes, the actual numbers, the following slide breaks that out for you and shows you exactly how many people we're talking about. So since the implementation of 3194, we've been comparing prison usage before the passage of the bill to prison usage after the passage of the bill. And we finally have a full good year baseline to look at those two things from. And so we're using the year complete calendar year of 2013 versus 2014. Even though in August 1st of 2013 is when 3194 went into effect, so there really were 5 months where it was into effect. A lot of the sentencing changes had to kind of work their way into the system, so we still feel pretty confident that's a pretty good baseline year to use. So these slides that you'll see are comparing those two calendar years, and you can see a year after 3194 going into effect, the areas that the legislation targets statutorily is kind of to the right, from identity theft, driving while suspended, rob three, marijuana crimes, and all other drugs. In each of those areas, the prison usage, the intakes have gone down. While at the same time, you can kind of see the property crimes are in that same general vein. while person crimes and sex crimes actually increased in intakes. But of course, 3194 did not target those. So one of the ways that we look at this is both on what we're calling first sentences and second sentences, or straight from the courtroom versus probation revocations. So this is your straight from the courtroom sentence to prison. And when you look at that comparing the years, statewide prison intakes were down by 191. And again, that mirrors the areas that 3194 really targeted. Looking at revocations in the next slide, you can see that we've had some increases in those same areas. So property crimes, we had more revocations. Identity theft, more revocations. Driving while suspended, robbery 3. And that actually is a good sign to us at the Criminal Justice Commission when we're thinking about implementation, because what that tells us is that more people are getting probation in those areas. So we would, in fact, expect that we would see an increase in revocations, as long as there's a decrease on the front end sentences. So this makes sense to us. More people are getting a chance at probation, therefore revocations are going up. But as you can see from these two slides, first sentences make up 80% of all of our prison usage, while revocations makes up 20%. So it's a smaller pool. Another way to look at it, because it's important to look at prison use in a lot of different ways. So you got to look at length of stay. You have to look at number of intakes. You have to look at when people are being released. And so this just completely adds up the sentences. So taking everybody who was sentenced in 2013 and just multiplying their sentences by the number of intakes and doing the same thing in 2014. So you can see that for the state, we actually had an increase in total prison usage. But the areas where we're seeing those increases has largely been in the person and sex crimes. And we have seen the decreases in the areas that House Bill 3194 targeted. So then this next slide kind of dives in a little bit deeper into just the specific sentencing changes in 3194. Because, of course, one of the things we're very interested in monitoring is, are those sentencing changes working the way that we thought that they would work? And so it's important to note for this slide, where we're talking about average length of stay, that some of the sentencing changes impacted length of stay and some of them did not. So identity theft was one of those crimes where the length of stay was reduced by 6 months. So the presumptive sentence was reduced from 24 months to 18 months. So we would expect to see that the average length of stay for identity theft crimes across the state over a year would have gone down. We anticipated, or we estimated originally, obviously wrongly, that it would go down by 6 months. At first, we were not seeing this necessarily phase in, and we were concerned, but after looking at a comparison of the 2 years, we've seen that it's gone down by 3 months. This kind of makes sense when knowing identity theft as a prosecutor. Identity thefts don't typically come with just one. They come with multiple and sometimes very many multiples, as opposed to like a stolen car, for example, where you'd really expect to see that one-for-one sentence reduction. So we probably misestimated at the front end at how much of an impact that this would have. Again, looking at the other crimes, driving while suspended, you can see that the average length of sentence went up. Marijuana and all other drug, those average length of sentences went up. This is also, we think, a good sign for how 3194 is working, because what this tells us is that the cases that are remaining in the system are the more serious cases that are receiving longer sentences. Because we know that there have been less intakes in each of these areas, the shorter sentence cases are being removed from the total pool, which means the average length of stay is going to be of just those remaining higher length cases. So those are good signs for us. Robbery in the third degree went up slightly. It's essentially pretty much flat. That was another length of stay change. Again, the legislation changed the length of stay from 24 months to 18 months, a presumptive sentence. But as you can see, the average across the state sentence is 16 months. So even though it stayed essentially the same and didn't go down by 6 months, it really couldn't have gone down by 6 months, because we're already sentencing below the presumptive sentence on average. So this next slide really is intended to look at the total number of cases that go through our system, because When you see at the outset when I say that we have 188 less prison intakes, you might say to yourself, well, maybe just less people went through the system. So it's important to see the total number of cases that have actually gone through the system. And what this shows you is that Oregon was remarkably constant between the 2 years and how many cases were put through the system. But what we're seeing is that more people received probation and more people received local sentences than received prison sentences. So it's not just that we had less cases. The other big sentencing change in House Bill 3194 that's probably had the biggest impact on bed savings is the short-term transitional leave program. This slide shows you by month how the law change has phased in. The orange bar on top represents the 90 days of short-term trans leave. It took some months for us to see our first 90-day case because you had to actually be sentenced and serve your time before you're eligible to get out on the back end. So it took some time for this sentencing change to phase in. But you can see as we move on, the bar is going to be more and more of the 90-day trans leave cases and less of the 30-day trans leave cases. And the next slide breaks it out by county of the counties that have received trans leave cases. So you can see Multnomah County has received the most short-term trans leave cases. Talking a little bit more about the short-term trans leave program and how I said that it was one of the biggest bed savers in the bill. Of all of the people who have been given the 90-day short-term trans leave, at the time this slide was prepared, that was 1,438, quick math. And you can see that of those, only 4.2% actually failed on their short-term trans leave. And what that means for the community is that we used 1,075 jail beds on sanctioning people in the short-term trans leave in the communities locally, which offsets the number of prison bed days we would have used had they stayed in prison, which is 42,383 days. So the offset is really quite large. And there was a lot of concern when the bill first passed that maybe this would just be shifting people from prison into local county jails. So this slide also really shows you that that has not been the case. It's not just been a one-for-one shift. In fact, it's had quite a lot of savings. So this slide, and this has the most up-to-date April 2015 forecast, really tells the story of where we were when the legislature was looking at passing House Bill 3194, where we are today, and where we are predicted to go. The dotted line is if we would have crossed that line, which we were projected to do in 2014, Deer Ridge would have had to been open to accommodate the prison population. And if you follow that green line all the way to the top right slide, you can see that by 2017, we were targeted to be building Junction City, or to be opening Junction City, rather, which, of course, is the bulk of the cost that the legislature was looking to avoid by implementing these changes. The black line shows you what we've done since the passage of House Bill 3194. And the orange line shows you that where we're projected to go in the future. And the next slide takes it out to 2023. And you can see it's not until July 2019 instead of 2014 that we're projecting to need Deer Ridge. And as far as this graph goes out to 2023, we're still not going to cross the Junction City line. So at this point, I have got every single county's individual prison usage. So this is there for you to look through, and happy to answer any questions.
Representative Krieger.
Does this take population growth into consideration on your projections?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, the forecast projections, it does. That's why you see that uptick where it kind of goes down for a little while and then it eventually is going to go up. That's taking into consideration the population growth.
Cool.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, your projections, how did you factor in Measure 91? We were told Measure 91 is going to decrease even further. And what's the projection for intake, short-term, long-term, for as a result of Measure 91?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, we really have not taken into consideration how Measure 91 is going to impact. We're primarily concerned with the prison population. And so looking at just those numbers, you can see, let me go back to how many cases go to prison on just marijuana crimes. It's a very, very small number. So as far as people not going to prison that would have before, we think it'll have a very small impact.
Is that Representative Wisnett? Mr. Smith, that's slide 11. Is that what we're looking at? Slide 11 had all other drugs were up 2.3 months for the state.
Yep.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, so there's tons of other data also on OLIS if you want to have some late night reading tonight, gentlemen and ladies. All right, thank you, Mr. Schwitt.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt.
We appreciate it. Could we please bring up the next panel, Bob Herman, and I'm not sure how the rest would like to proceed.
Chair Shields, just in the order that you've got them there.
Okay, thank you.
Alex Gardner.
You can do two at a time if you like.
All right. Alex Gardner. Welcome to the committee, Mr. District Attorneys. Fire away.
Thank you. I'll begin, co-chairs and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Bob Herman. I'm the district attorney from Washington County and serving as the ODA president this year. And I'd like to briefly talk about what we've done in Washington County with the Justice Reinvestment Funds. When we sat down to meet the sheriff, the community corrections director, county administrator, and myself, sat down and asked what we could do to target the individuals in our county that would be most fittingly served by these monies. And we decided just to get into it look at particularly the, first of all, the transitional leave population. That was a population that's coming out, you know, no matter what. And so we wanted to figure out a way that we could effectively keep them, as many of them as possible, from going back as they had in the past. We also looked at what we call the downward departure population, and so those are people with, based upon their record, based upon the nature of their crimes, their presumptive sentence was prison. So, for example, they were presumed to serve a 24-month prison sentence. But because a judge had made a decision that they were going to impose probation instead, or the parties in many cases had made an agreement through a stipulation to recommend a probationary sentence, we wanted to put some resources into that group to better ensure that they were getting the oversight, the treatment, the services needed so that they didn't then come back with probation revocations and head to prison, you know, four or six months later. And then we also had a population of a second look, and those are juveniles who, at the time of sentencing, are given a sentence typically through Measure 11 crime where they can, at the halfway mark, they can come back before the court and demonstrate that based upon their performance or behavior and so forth in the institution, balanced with what they've done, that they have an opportunity to come back into the community and go on probation. And that was a population we used a lot of second look in our county, as it happens. And so that was a population that we felt needed some additional services and resources. So, again, they didn't end up going back. So we put some focus on it. So that was the beginning. The sheriff and I said, you know, to do this, let's put all the money into the community corrections. And so we did. And we were fortunate in Washington County in that we have a drug court. We had a drug court for about 10 years now. And our drug court model involves non-property offenders that are high risk. Literally high risk. Our first graduate took a big gulp, but our first graduate we allowed in the program had a 60-month prison sentence facing her. And we've had some graduates with up to 90 months, 120 months, with chronic ID theft, some frequent convictions. And so So in other words, we've had a program that we've dealt with high-risk offenders through our drug court, as well as chronic probation violators. So we move somebody into our drug court with a significant drug problem that's a chronic probation violator. And so the advantage of that was that over time we've kind of learned, we've picked up things, and so we actually had a model that's kind of geared for this new population that we wanted to focus on. Those are people who are coming out. They've already been in prison some many times, or they're on a probation, a presumed prison sentence, they're on probation. And so we felt that some of the things we learned in drug court with that high-risk population would serve us well. And so a few slides just to demonstrate in our program of supervising this population. These are just some of the program partners. But what we've done, it wasn't particularly rocket science, but we took some things that were very successful in drug court and some other features and really put our resources into them and build these relationships. And as you can see, such things as even working with the Social Security Administration, our jail has done a great job of that, of getting people identification, getting people connected to services, getting them the tools that they need to actually go out and try to get a job, as well as those employment services that work with job seeking and job placement. Mentors has been huge in our program. We learned in our drug court fairly quickly that having mentors to work with those individuals, people that have been there and have turned it around, are very valuable to the success of probationers. Oxford House's Clean and Sober Housing in Washington County. I mean, every county is different, and that's why this program is so good. It enables you to look to see what your county may have that may work. And Clean and Sober Housing has been critical to our drug court. And as you know, the populations kind of intersect. They may not be completely a drug court candidate, but they have a drug issue or an alcohol issue that these services serve well. And even the public safety factor, the GPS and SCRAM, just some actual tools. I call them electronic bracelets, but actually having tools that help people transition so that they're keeping an eye on them. At the same time, they're keeping the public safe.
Representative Krieger, might we ask a question here?
What is your – do you have a cost – per case compared to incarceration for that same period of time?
Co-chairs and Representative Krieger, I don't know with the present program we've built, we've got those numbers yet. I know in drug court, because we say it with our graduations, and we've had over 150 of them, the judge points out that our drug court is a pretty expensive model. It's very intensive, and it probably costs $7,000 to $10,000, and usually our graduates, it's at least 18 months, and it's sometimes up to 3 years. And so the judge basically points out, you've saved us about $30,000 a year. And so that's something we want to look to going forward, is to try to get the numbers here with our IRIS and this and those that succeed and make those comparisons. Yes, sir. So, and then just briefly, this is we call an IRIS program. This is the program set up, and these are where some of the monies went into: POs, recovery mentors, employment specialists, the treatment, an IRIS house, so it's clean and sober, in addition to clean and sober housing, drug testing, again, and flex funds, things that really are kind of needed to get people in a place where they can move on. I mean, I guess traditionally you'd say, well, why are we giving them giving people these handouts? And the reality is that these are basically in order to get the tools in place to get going. They need to get a start. And so that's what we've done. Our IRIS program, as I mentioned, right now it's nonviolent drug and property offenders facing prison, as well as, people coming out. There's assessments done by the Community Corrections Division and sentencing by the court. I'll jump ahead. Going forward, we're looking at, right now we have non-property offenders, and as I mentioned, we have second look. We use a second look quite a bit in our county. And there's this, traditionally with our drug court, the federal funding, you could not have crimes of violence, and so we were pretty limited in terms of who we may have, both not only the crime that they were being sentenced for, but the crimes that they committed in the past. One of the things we're looking at as we're trying to work through the success here is with our second look, a lot of our second look juveniles are kids involved in gang-related activities, and so they're so they are crimes of, you know, violence. That's one of the things we're looking with expanded funding is to be able to focus on that population. You know, if they're coming back, if they've qualified and the courts deemed them able to be in the community safely, then we don't want them to be limited by the non-property or the, you know, the property crimes limitation. We want to be able to selectively identify those that can be helped with this program and these fundings. And then just briefly, here's a caseload summary of what we've done, 203 cases. You can see the numbers. There's 50 that were initially assessed, 153 secondary cases. And it's like anything else. It's a program that the judges have to gain confidence in. The prosecutors have to gain confidence in. The defense has to gain confidence in. And we're working as we move along. That's what happened in our drug court. We're much farther ahead than when we started in terms of who gets in and how they're processed. And the last thing, which certainly is an important piece, as you all know and recognize, is part of the bill. This is just a couple of the whereases, and the underlining is mine, but it's the state of Oregon continues to focus prison resources on violent offenders while protecting the public and holding all offenders accountable. And the bottom, it's using resources necessary to hold offenders accountable and reduce future criminal conduct. When I talk to our grand jurors, when they exit about 35 every 5 weeks, and I talk about our drug court program, I have to step back a little bit because, mind you, they've just heard weeks and weeks and weeks of crime cases, and they're kind of up to their eyeballs in hearing what's going on. And so I talk a little bit about the drug court, and I have to get a little bit defensive when I do, because they go, wait a minute, you mean one of these guys that's constantly ID theft, constantly ripping people off, is going into probation when they, you know, with their record and so forth. And so and that's what all of us in the course in the system and through the legislation want to make sure is that people are going in the program, we're keeping the public safe. And the good thing about what we've developed in our county through this program is we've developed a comfort level with the type of resources the program has and the type of results we're seeing that we can do it. There's still an adversary system in place where we don't always agree, but through that process, we're able to make some changes and use this money effectively and keep the public safe in the process. So it's not just saying, okay, you all just go into this program. There's an accountability feature that everybody recognizes and is enforced. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Herman. I do appreciate the great work, particularly the reputation of the Washington County Community Corrections has always been kind of viewed as being very progressive and forward-thinking. And so I think those partnerships that you're developing will serve the state well. Thank you. Mr. Gardner.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alex Gardner, and I'm the Lane County DA. If I may, I'd like to begin by saying a couple of things about two questions that Representative Krieger asked. He asked earlier about the cost of corrections or the prison use, whether it reflected the populations in the various counties. And the fact is, it doesn't strictly follow the population curve. It follows the offender curve more accurately. So you'll see that Multnomah, Marion, and Lane use more of the prison capacity, even though Washington and Clackamas are more populous. It's because Lane, Multnomah, and Marion have a larger offender problem, and there are a number of reasons for that. There are other challenges that are present in those areas too, including, speaking for Lane, a higher poverty rate, more kids in foster care, lots of other challenges. Lane County embraced 3194 very enthusiastically. We were in desperate need for support for the basic tools that avoid prison use. So we needed supervision. Those of you who were part of the 416 program when it was first proposed by Ross Shepard, our public defender, and Doug Harkleroad will remember that Lane County wanted to be able to participate in that but couldn't provide the basic corrections infrastructure to make it happen. So we were sort of left on the sidelines. The reason for that is because of Lane County's profound funding shortage as a result of loss in timber revenue. I don't mean to dwell on that, but I think that Lane County is a useful example because it shows what happens when you don't have those essential resources, which 3194 is helping with. So you'll also notice, if you look into the data that Mr. Schmidt has provided, that early on in this program, Lane County had a spike in prison usage. And the reason for that is we passed early on, and about the same time, we passed a small jail levy, which brought Lane County's local jail capacity up to about a third of Oregon's average jail capacity per 1,000 reported crimes. And what happened as a result of that is all these offenders that were out in the community with outstanding warrants were suddenly prosecutable because when they got rearrested, we could hold them long enough to move the case forward. I mention that because what happens when you don't have those essential resources, and I'm talking about local corrections capacity, treatment, supervision, reentry, all those pieces, when you don't have them, the system slips, and you end up with offenders who continue to offend, particularly drug offenders, people who are addicted, and they develop enormous criminal histories, which means that there are going to be a lot of very upset victims. There's going to be a very long presumptive sentence because instead of sentencing them on one burglary, you're sentencing them on seven or nine. And that's what happened in Lane County. So as soon as we had a little bit of corrections capacity, we had a bunch of these offenders arrested and the prison use spiked. But shortly after that, as we started to realize the benefits from 3194, you see the drop in prison usage, and that's been more or less sustained. I mention that because I'm very anxious about the loss of that support resulting in the programs collapsing and returning to that high prison use trajectory. It's sort of a triple whammy because you end up with offenders who have this much greater sentencing liability. You also have circuit judges who don't have any safe options in the local community. If you tell a judge, we have the capacity to supervise this person, there's going to be some treatment, it's going to be real and meaningful supervision, they can put the person on probation. If the only option for the local community is prison, then that's what the judges default to, and that's what they have to default to in order to protect the community. So we are poised in Lane County on the edge of duplicating Marion's 416 program. There's a lot of excitement around that, and we're hopeful that that's going to happen. We're working out the details now and working out the research component as well. And I think I'll leave it with that and see if there are any questions rather than prattle on.
Mr. Gardner, so what was the total amount of money that Lane County received?
Chair and members of the co-chairs and member of the committee, I don't want to shoot from the hip. I think I know, but I don't want to shoot from the hip, so I'm going to defer to Mr. Schmidt.
Okay. Is he still? He is in the back. We'll get him up in just a little bit. And then, so you were kind of using it in a path similar to Washington County on kind of the reentry side, or more, how would you categorize those?
I'd say the reentry side is big. We have sponsors, which is a fantastic program, and it's very well integrated into our system. As you may know, we have POs who are stationed at sponsors, so it's a real partnership. But we're trying to get the 416 program fully implemented. So we're focusing on the high and medium high risk offenders. Like Washington County, our drug court focuses on those. We also have a robust veterans program. We're also trying to manage the co-occurring disorder folks. So I'd say it's the paupers version of the Washington County program.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Senator Bates?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for coming late. I had to give a long presentation to another committee. My other committee that I chair is takes care of drug and alcohol issues supposedly for the state, and Senator Winters is there with me. How much of your property crime do you estimate is driven by drug and alcohol, And how good is the program in your county for getting people off drugs, off alcohol, and out of crime? That's a very broad statement. I know you work with your drug court, but how well is it working? Do you have numbers on it? How do you compare it to other counties? We've been told many times that the real driver for a lot of property crime is really drugs. And we need to work on that more and not just work on capacity in jails and longer sentences and all those type of things. We'll never solve this without resolving that. So I'd like to hear what you have to say about that, because that's our other budget we have to work with.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee, Senator Bates. Our programs have been very effective. So you asked what the proportions were in property crime. I've heard people say as high as 80%, but my background is in science, and I never buy that without roots that show the origins of that. What I can tell you is that in Lane County a number of years ago, we asked the POs, and this was our offender population at that time in Lane County, the population being served was over 3,000. All the POs were asked to look through the records of the people that they supervised, and if they had ever tested hot for methamphetamine, or been arrested for methamphetamine, or they admitted to prior or current methamphetamine use, they got checked yes. And when all of those were put together in aggregate, it was about 60% of the population being supervised. So it's a very significant influence. It may be the largest single influence. It is not, I don't think, as large as some people claim it is. But it doesn't matter, because it's a profound influence. And that was just methamphetamine. There's also heroin and other opiates, and it's a huge challenge. In terms of how well we do in Lane County, I think exceptionally well. We were one of the first drug courts in the state to go to a higher risk offender model. There are a lot of reasons why that makes more sense. But it also makes it more difficult to compare one drug court program against another, because some jurisdictions are still putting very low-risk offenders into drug court, and those people don't reoffend at a high rate anyway. So the most sensible thing to do is to manage the medium and high-risk offenders, because if you aren't successful in moderating their behavior, the consequences are enormous. So. And we've been very successful both on the drug court side and the other program side.
Thank you. I'll follow up offline. I think we have to make some tough decisions on our side about how much to put into those, what resources to put in, and how to put them in, not just put them in. Mm-hmm. So we'll be looking at this more.
Senator Winters?
Just a follow-up question, probably for all of the DAs that come up, and the question is, how accessible and available are the resources from alcohol and drug? Because that's a question that the senator and I grapple with over on the human resources side.
Senator,
you can begin thinking about it.
and we can take honesty.
Yeah.
We think there's gaps, and I'm being kind by saying that.
Yeah.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, members of the committee, what I can say is that it's better than it used to be. It's not as good as we'd like it to be. There are certainly gaps. And Mr. Schmidt has been kind enough to give me the hard number, and it's 1.389 million. And if I may, there was one other question that I just wanted to take a poke at that Representative Krieger asked, and that was sort of the cost-benefit analysis for drug courts. And I don't have the numbers now for our program, but I will say this, that our program has delivered a number of clean babies. And I saw data that suggested that one methamphetamine-addicted baby can cost as much as $500,000 in state-related care. So I see it as in the green column or the black column every time we deliver a clean baby in drug court, and we've done it a lot. So I'd say our drug court program is well into the black, even if you don't look at the prison cost that we've avoided.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Callahan and Mr. Myers.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Tim Colahan. I'm Harney County District Attorney. And I am here to give you the pauper's perspective of House Bill 3194. Actually, I do want to talk a little bit about a small county perspective. And to put it into context, the RIC numbers that you saw that Mr. Schmidt put up on the board, the Eastern and Central RIC, which my county is a part of, accounts for about 11% of the prison population. The other three RICs account for 89%. So obviously, the prison usage that most of Central and Eastern Oregon are involved in is small in perspective, but it's still important work. And the DAs in those counties are certainly engaged in this process of making sure that 3194 is implemented. And we also realize the importance of the Justice Reinvestment Funds. There's a couple of things that impact a small county in looking at running these types of programs. The first is that our prison usage numbers can be so dramatically affected by what are really small changes in the offenders that we're dealing with. And the second is that it's difficult for the small counties that don't have a lot of programs, don't have a lot of resources, to be able to run a program like the 416 program, what you've heard about Washington County, and also in Multnomah County, and you'll hear from DA Underhill. Having said that, Harney County in 2013-15, we received the minimum grant. It was $50,000. But I worked with the sheriff, our presiding court judge, members of our county commission, as well as members of our LipSync, and we targeted three different areas. The first was treatment court. We have had a drug court. We call it our treatment court. We focus on high-risk, high-needs individuals that are both drug offenders and also property offenders. And what we did with that money is we tried to increase the treatment that is available to these folks in order to increase the number of enrollees that the court could actually put into the program. The second need we looked at was transitional leave housing. We have people coming out of the Department of Corrections, coming into a community like Harney County that just does not have housing available for these folks. So we looked at increasing our transitional leave housing. We also looked at creating a reentry court to run in connection with our treatment court for folks that were coming out of prison that are still experiencing problems in drug and alcohol use and are in need of that enhanced type of supervision. The future, looking ahead, the minimum grant we're looking at, Mr. Schmidt tells me, for Harney County is $100,000. That's double what we're getting now. Obviously, we're hoping for more than that with full funding of the program. But full funding of 3194 Justice Reinvestment is so critical to all the counties, and particularly the small counties in Oregon. The sentencing changes that you know about in 3194 have really created the flattening of the prison usage in Oregon. What we haven't seen yet, because we haven't been able to fully measure it yet, is what is the impact of the enhanced programming that's going to be available and has been made available through the Justice Reinvestment Programs. I've always felt, and several of the DAs have felt, that that's the biggest bang for the buck, is trying to deal with people, making sure that they're successful on probation, they're successful on post-prison supervision, so they're not being revoked and not being sent back to prison. And that is why the funding under 3194 is so important to all counties. I have to put a pitch in for the smaller counties because we simply don't have a lot of resources. Thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm Marion County Sheriff, and I'm here today helping out the DAs. I'm helping out my DA who's out of town. So I'll be talking a little bit about the work that we've done in our county. And I'm going to start first with Senate Bill 416. That is kind of our flagship program, and I refer to us as early adopters around justice reinvestment. We've had a longstanding reentry program, and in the 2011 session, both Walt and I were in here working on that session, and this Senate Bill 416 bill came up. And while it didn't go very far in the session, we really liked the concepts around it and knew that we had the infrastructure in place in our community to do something a little bit different than what we were doing with medium to high risk nonviolent property crime offenders. And so we worked together after the session with the CJC to get a grant to the tune of about $500,000 to run this program in 2012. And so that's what we did, and we had agreed in the grant that we would take 50 offenders who normally would be destined for prison. We place them into this program, which would have strict supervision. It would have services and that were specific to the criminogenic risks and needs of the offender. And we saw some really good results with this program. Now, mind you, this is a tough offender population. These are the ones that typically go to prison for 18 to 24 months and recidivate at a very high rate, unfortunately. A lot of them have drug addiction problems. And so a lot of our program is focused around drug treatment and addressing those criminogenic needs. At the end of the grant period, we had 50 offenders that went into this program, and the rough math we did is that it was about a $500,000 investment. It saved about $1.5 million in what would have been prison bed days. So, and the recidivism rate was right around 11%, and normally for this population it's around 20. So we saw really good results. So as a justice reinvestment rolled out in the 2013 session, we already had this program up and running. It was a natural for us to continue it. And so that's been our flagship program with the justice reinvestment dollars. And to date, during the biennium, we've had 86 individuals enter into this program that would have been destined and would have gone to prison. 90% of them have remained in the community, so about 10% actually had to go to prison because of their shortcomings or issues that have come up on their supervision. And the recidivism rate for this population is around 11%. And again, the general population, if they went to prison, then we supervise them, their recidivism rate is around 20%. And the statewide rate for this is about 24%. So we're showing a really good lower recidivism rate for this population in this program. Now, this isn't the only investment we make in Marion County. It's an important one, and it works really well, and it really hits that population that was really growing the prisons. We also use some of our justice reinvestment dollars for our prison reentry program, which we call the SOAR program. It's Student Opportunity for Achieving Results. And this is on the grounds of Chemeketa Community College. It's a 16-week program for high-risk offenders that come back to our community from prison. It's very specific to basic teaching these individuals basic life skills, working with them on drug treatment issues, parenting issues, all of the issues that they face coming out of prison. And that program is showing tremendous results. I believe our recidivism rate is around 11% for that population. And again, that's a population that doesn't receive that kind of programming and supervision is around 20 to 24%. The other thing I think it's really important to know is that the work that we do is collaborative. I work very closely with my district attorney, and he's a good man, and he has agreed to implement these things with a lot of trust in my office to supervise folks. And that working relationship, that collaboration allows us opportunities. And one of the things that we have noticed is that the female population in DOC is rising. And there's a willingness on our behalf to jointly work together and take a look at the Washington program, the family sentencing program, to really kind of go after that population, see what we can do to lower the amount of females going to prison and work with them in our local community. So in closing, I would like to say, and I think Representative Williamson, you coined this very well last Monday, justice reinvestment has been great for our state, but has been even better for law enforcement, because you see DAs and sheriffs and chiefs and community stakeholders all working together to keep our community safe, to lower our prison usage, to bolster our local programs. You hear, whether it's a small county or a big county, these dollars matter and they're doing good things. And I would ask that we continue to support that, because I think we'll see better and better results from these investments. So thank you.
Representative Krieger.
I'll follow Krieger.
Mr. Coleman, how long have you been DA in the county?
27 years.
It would be great value to me if I could spend 15 or 20 minutes with you privately over an issue.
Be happy to do that.
Senator Winters.
Just a request, because I know that in addition to the work that's being done with respect to Senate Bill 416 and SCORE, you might want to touch on, because this body's also interested in what's happening in mental health.
Just real briefly.
Yes.
As you know, in Marion County, we've been working very diligently around the issue of mental health and diversion. And with the investment dollars that came in the 2013 biennium, we've really kind of added to the relationships that we had, and added some assets in the community around mobile crisis that have done some amazing things in terms of lowering the folks that were coming to our jail, that were mentally ill, that were going to the Salem Hospital, that were going to the state hospital. So those investments are paying huge dividends, and we're continuing to build our system to really treat people with mental illness the way they should be treated, and that's in the community and not in the criminal justice system.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. My district attorney, D.A. Underhill, and John Hummel.
Chair Shields, Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is John Hummel. I'm the district attorney in Deschutes County. Deschutes County's Justice Reinvestment Program plan, it contains three strategies. I won't go through all of them in detail. You have my written testimony. But first strategy is operated solely by the Adult Parole and Probation Department. The second two strategies require the active involvement and leadership from the district attorney. That first strategy is working fine. It addresses the transitional leave population that we've talked about, the individuals who are released 90 days instead of 30 days prior to completion of the program. I think every county that you've heard about is different how we're addressing the needs of that particular population. A special problem in Deschutes County is housing. It strikes me how these issues we hear about in other committees impact, across the board, every issue. But we've talked about housing before. But it's an issue for our parole and probation department as we're trying to reintegrate these individuals into Deschutes County. They're running into significant problems addressing their housing needs. But other than that, which is a big problem, the program is working very well, that strategy for us. Now, the other two strategies that need to involve the active involvement of the district attorney, they're described in the written materials. I have to confess, I've been on the job 3 months. My first month or so was taken over by figuring out where to park and how to figure out the password to my computer. Second month, we had two significant death investigations that I jumped into. But this most recent month, in preparation for the Justice Reinvestment Summit, last week, I started digging into our JRP program. And when I say our, I mean the program that's run in the district attorney's office. And I have to tell you, I was disappointed by what I saw, quite candidly. What I saw was no deputy district attorney in my office was aware of the program, and we weren't implementing it. And that's unacceptable, and that's not going to continue. But when you look into the numbers, I think you'll see the impact of that. We've seen that Deschutes County's prison beds have gone up by 30% from 2013 to 2014. That's unacceptable. And sitting here, it becomes even more clear to me the importance, if this program is going to work, of the active leadership and involvement of district attorneys. And the gentleman you've heard here from today show you what happens when a district attorney commits to this program and works hard. It hasn't happened in Deschutes County from the district attorney's side. It's happened from parole and probation, from the courts. I want to be clear about that. But it has not happened from the district attorney's side, and that will change. I've spoken to our director of our parole and probation department. We're meeting on Wednesday with my chief deputy, and we're going to change things. You have my commitment that you'll see the type of leadership in my office that you've heard from these other district attorneys. So apologies that I deliver bad news, but when you ask me to give a report, I'm going to be frank with you. So we'll do better in the future. And I'll write you a letter next month and let you know what our new plan is going forward.
Thank you for your candor. District Attorney Underhill, welcome to the committee.
Hey, well, thank you very much, Co-Chair Senator Shields, Representative Williamson, members of the committee. Thank you for having me. We'll take just maybe a moment, if I can, get the PowerPoint up. Looks like it's all set. Hey, well, it starts off with, once again, thank you for having me come before you. And I'm very proud to have personally joined Oregon District Attorneys Association in its support of 3194 back 2 years ago, when I'm looking at some faces where we worked real hard at making sure we got a product, a solid product out that both accomplished the goal that we set forth to do, control our prison growth, while simultaneously making it safe in our communities. And I think we're doing that. It's a work in progress. I'm listening to everyone. I'm sure DA Hummel's going to step right up and join us, and we'll have a much more solid, better report on behalf of his county now that he's been able to sink his teeth into it and whatnot. Hey, let me focus on Multnomah County's effort and what we've been working to do. So let's see. I think I need to grab this. All right, so we have our program, MCJRP, stands for Multnomah County's Justice Reinvestment Program. And we established some goals early on. They probably ring true to everything that you've learned about the things that we want to do relative to justice reinvestment. We're going to increase short and long-term public safety. Now, do you see very often long-term public safety? And the answer is maybe not as much as we should. But the goal here is not just a one-year plan, it's not a two-year plan, it's a 5- and 10-year plan. It's a plan to offer services to individuals that we're dealing with today that are going to correct whatever that, whether it be an alcohol addiction, drug addiction, mental health matters. But you and I know that those folks have, they live in our communities, they have children, they have friends, they have associates, and we think that we can impact those people as well if we have a long-term vision about getting these folks healthy when we have the opportunities. So that's that long-term vision in a nutshell. We want to reduce recidivism, and we all know what that means. Decrease utilization of Oregon Department of Corrections prison beds. We're going to decrease victimization simultaneously, and we're going to increase victims' input and their into our process. And then lastly, we're going to hold offenders accountable, and this can be done not with a heavy hand at all times. This can be done dealing with kid gloves at times and everything in between. Senator Winters, Senator Bates, you asked some earlier questions of folks. I listened to it. It ruminated with me. How are we doing relative to access to treatment beds in our community? I can speak for Multnomah County. It's a challenge. We're already using them up. We don't have enough. It's a big conversation for us, and we're having these conversations weekly. We have already very quickly, and I'll get to the numbers here in a minute for Multnomah County, but we're already having waiting lists because of this increased need for those beds, hard beds sometimes, and the fact that they simply do not exist. Why don't they exist? I can only pass on, and I've had significant conversations, for example, with Tim Hartnett, the executive director of COTA. What Tim would tell you, I believe, I don't want to get it wrong, but if he were sitting here, he'd tell you, one of the problems is infrastructure. One of the problems is the business, if you think of treatment as both philosophically motivated, but also it's a business in some sense. People that get into that business need to know that they can rely on the fact that they're going to be open a year from today and not have to shut down. And so one of the challenges that they would describe to you, or Tim would describe to you, is kind of a long-term vision of the treatment providers in their ability to have ongoing business opportunity. In other words, 2 or 3 or 4 year reliance on funding. And so that's a big deal. And that has not been something that they've been able to enjoy over the last handful of years. We're optimistic, but this conversation, frankly, is a little bit critical to that that vision. What's the funding gonna look like relative to 3194 and the ability for those folks to have some long-term vision on opening beds and making them available. Hey, well, let me move on to next slide.
DeAndre Hill, just a moment. Senator.
Yes.
Sir.
I want to go back to, thank you, Mr. Chair. Uh-huh. I want to go back to both Mr. Hummel and you on the housing issue. I want to make sure we're talking the same thing.
Sure.
We're having some special meetings on mental health as far as housing is concerned, A&D housing, and I think you're talking about probation or a combination of these. When you say you need more housing and there's waiting lists, what are you really talking about? In some counties like Multnomah and Deschutes, where housing is tight for everybody and expensive,
yes,
it becomes even more difficult to put these programs together. And I think what you're talking about also, the long-term funding, is if people make investments in capital investments in housing, they need to know that's going to hold up for them. They're going to have funding for it. I think that's what you're talking about. Could you give me just a little bit more on that, please?
You bet. Now I'll do.
Humble, you feel free to.
Yes. Yes, I'll do my best. And again, I'm a listener in this area. I wouldn't call myself an expert in the treatment area, but I listen hard, and I hope I've got it right. If I think of it like this, there's a finite number of hard beds available in any jurisdiction, Multnomah County, for example. This isn't the number, but by way of understanding it, let me just say there's 1,000. 1,000 beds are competing now with everyone. The criminal justice system is just one party to the competition for these hard beds. They're being competed for by private industry. They're being competed for by a number of other folks. One of the challenges, as I understand it, for criminal justice system is what are we willing to pay for per night versus Affordable Care Act and others that may be able to and willing to pay more. And if you're the holder of 1,000 beds, it's a business decision oftentimes that you're going to enter into and who you're going to sell those beds to, so to speak. So we're finding, we're discovering with this conversation, it's a great conversation to have and to educate ourselves, meaning we're all in it and we're trying to figure it out. But what we're discovering is the multitude of challenges for those finite number of beds, high competition for them, because of high need, and that the criminal justice system, when I started about 25 years ago, I think we had more of a front row seat or front row ability to get those beds, and now the competition has gotten much more stiff, and we're neck and neck and sometimes maybe even behind in our ability to compete and pay for those beds. Does that help?
Helps a little. Conversation. It does. Thank you.
I can. Tim Hartnett is a wealth of knowledge in this area and could step in and do a much better job at summarizing it for me. I put you in contact with him. Shall I continue, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
All right. Very good.
Oh,
did you have
just Ranger, before you get too far, there were skeptics when we were doing 3194. I think there's three or four people here that on that committee, and they're. Opposition suggested that we would create more victims. It would appear recidivism is down. That probably didn't happen. Do we know anything about that?
Well, in Multnomah County, we do not believe that we've had enough time to accurately measure recidivism on our program, the MCJRP program. Let me give you a little more detail about that, Representative Krieger. We began our program, the MCJRP program, July 1st of 2014. So here we are, not even a year into it. So our ability to really look at the recidivism rate, we just simply haven't had enough time. So I am constantly, with our large group that meets just about weekly, I'm constantly having conversations that we need to keep an eye on. Is what we're doing working? Is it going to work? It frankly, sir, is too early to tell for my county's program. We are hyper-vigilant about it. I'll get to, if I may, some other aspects that are hoping to make sure that we are not creating more victims, but it is front and center on my radar to make sure that we don't have that impact.
So, Mr. Chair, I want to make sure we understand what we thought was going to happen is happening, that the opponents were happening to be in error, because if not, then we've got to adjust what we're doing. So as time passes, even if it's next February in our short session, that the DAs and everybody be able to come in and talk to us a little bit about that.
I think we should, I'd love to keep an eye on this and come back and tell you where we think we are back in that window of time.
Fine, thank you.
You bet. Hey, well, let me continue then. The MCJRP sentencing practices go beyond the sentencing changes in 3194. You've had some background about what those were, so I won't spend much time on that. But our program has made a larger range of drug and property crimes, but we've even dipped into the area of some person crimes and Tier 2 ballot measure 11 offenses. In other words, let me have you think in your mind, who's eligible for Multnomah County's MCJRP program? And the answer is approximately 1,000 people per year fit this presumptive prison category and are going to presumptively, or will in the beginning, be eligible for the program. Who's not? And I'll summarize that. Tier 1 Measure 11, homicide cases, domestic violence, sex abuse, child victims. And then the answer is everything else is presumptive prison. For us, that's about 1,000 people a year. To get your bearings about what we did before the passage of 3194 and before MCJRP program began July 1st of 2014, and the answer is of that 1,000 people or so, about 48% received probation. Now, under the MCJRP, understanding that we've only, you know, we're 9 months into it or so, but we've done our analysis and we've done our extrapolation, what you're going to see is instead of 48% receiving probation, we're now running at a rate of about 70% are receiving probation. 70% of these presumptive prison individuals are receiving probation in this program. Now, how are we doing that? That's a pretty significant, that's a very significant change in my opinion. Well, we're doing it with having better informed professional decision making, which I'll circle back around to and explain a little more thoroughly. System-wide collaboration between prosecution, defense, court, and probation. I think Sheriff Myers touched on it. You've seen collaboration. I've seen collaboration that we haven't seen possibly in many, many years in this area. We're increasing offender supervision services and satisfying obligations to victims and the accountability piece. I'm not going to drill down super detail because it's hard to see some of this, some of what you're looking at on the lower right-hand corner, but I'll summarize it. We have an acronym, the PAVRON package. So what is the PAVRON package? It's information that's going to be collected on each of these approximately 1,000 cases. Some of this is old news and some of this is brand new news for what we're doing in the criminal justice department. The first point and what you see on top of this analysis wheel is professional judgment. Everything that we do is going to help inform the practitioners. Who are we really talking about? The sentencing point, primarily we're talking about the court, the defense counsel and their client, and the prosecution. We're going to inform ourselves better in making better decisions as we move into the sentencing phase. So what do we take into account as we analyze these cases? An accountability piece, I've already touched on that. Victim input and impact, already touched on that as well, but it's very significant relative to philosophical and constitutional obligations. We're doing something now that hasn't been done, at least in Oregon, and I think in a very few, if not almost, doesn't exist in the area of prosecution work, and that is we're administering a risk and needs assessment pre-adjudication. The LSCMI, a tool that's been used across the country, is being administered to these eligible individuals who still participate in the program. What's that going to tell us? And it's going to tell us recidivism rates from a static, and it's a static and dynamic tool. So it's both using historical data and asking some real-time questions about where they are in their pre-contemplative or contemplative phase of things. We're going to take into account the offense and mitigating and aggravating factors of dealing with a particular offense at issue. And finally, that LSCMI is going to tell us what that person's needs are. It's going to give us a first cut at the needs. It's by no means the beginning and end of what a person needs, but it's going to help inform their private counsel whether they need to dig in a little deeper in the area of drug, alcohol, mental health, those kinds of things. And we're going to get better detailed information. We're taking all of this information in the context of, and you see this is work that we've worked on back in Multnomah County. This is just one of many phases. We plug this material into an entire process within our criminal justice division. You see in the upper left-hand corner, that's where that PAVRON acronym is, in the upper left-hand corner. It weaves into phase two of the work that we do. Now, what happens downstream? Of those 1,000 cases, now about 700 approximately are going to get probation, and that's where they kick out at this end of the schematic that I've kind of sped through a little bit. We're going to look at putting some of these individuals in pre-existing, meaning already existing, treatment-based programs. Our START court, heavy emphasis on drug treatment surrounding the property crimes conversation. DISP is a high-intensive alcohol abuse program that we take advantage of. A mental health court that we have the luxury of having, and some of these folks go into that court, as well as a veterans docket. That's relatively new for us. The MCJRP program, specific relative to the supervision piece, is a 120-day extremely high-intensive supervision for all these people who, for whatever reason, don't find themselves in one of these other treatment programs. This is a deeper analysis, but time restraints can constrain us from drilling too deep into this. But as you can see, I hope I'm impress upon you, a high level of detail goes into the 120-day aspect of this. This is the part, Representative Krieger, to go back to your question, I think, really, is we want to make sure we're doing everything we can amongst the system partners to make sure that we are not having downstream victimization. The first studies that I've reviewed, but I can't quote them to you, but studies have shown us that first 120 days after a judgment has been signed, that's a high critical period and window of time. And so we're really putting some resources and focusing on that area. So within that 120-day program, assuming they don't go into one of our other specialty courts, what are we offering them? And these are a range of options that we're going to offer these offenders. No one person necessarily is going to get all of these things. They're going to be tailored to that individual, and that's one of the benefits of the program that we've designed. They're more utilitarian than just if a person entered a program. We have different degrees of low, medium, and high relative to drug abuse. So we're trying to look at the individual, not so much the offense for which they entered on. All right, let me move down and talking fast and speeding up because I think I've been up here for a while. But data collection, we have a robust, and I think I included in the packet for you, Multnomah County has quarterly data collection. We're asking every darn question we can even reasonably think of because we want to find out, is our program working? And what tells us, because different people ask different questions to determine whether it's going to work. We're not going to know, really going to know, for 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now. And we're going to look at pieces dealing with victim satisfaction, recidivism, victimization in the community. All those things are questions that we're very interested in. All right, the money. How are we doing? Are we saving the state any money? And how is it transferring into the offset into Multnomah County? All right, our program, going back to that 1,000 individuals that are eligible, and when you do the math, and you'll know that we're running at a rate of 70% receiving probation, how that filters out with when you do the math is 243 individuals will not be going to prison this year that went prior to 3194. So that's 243 in a calendar year that are MCJRP program individuals. What does this mean to the state? And the answer is, in a 12-month time period, and again, we've done some extrapolation because we're only 9 months or so into the program. The math, and we used a calculation below, 243 times $96 a day times a period of a year is, in 1 year, Multnomah County is saving the Department of Corrections about $8.5 million. We also look at that short-term transleave. You saw an earlier slide by Mike Schmidt. Multnomah County is a heavy, aggressive user, and that's by design of the short-term transleave. We knew that that was a critical piece of 3194 to make this the hydraulics work and to save the money for the goals that we set, and we're doing it. What does that equate to? And the answer is just north of $1.5 million in a 12-year period or a 12-month period of time. So we put those savings combined, and we're north of $10 million per year, Multnomah County and its MCJRP program are saving the state of Oregon in the form of Department of Corrections costs. One note, and I've noted it below, we are not calculating the length of stay reductions. That's another thing that should be calculated. We haven't done it. We just ran, I don't want to say we ran out of time, but I do want to note it. And that is, we are running at a length of stay that is lower, 2.3 across the board. And in the areas of 3194 crimes, we're running at 6.5 months less for length of stay in the area of identity theft. and a half a month in the area of all other drugs. So that calculation, if we looked at those savings, would bring that savings to the state even more than $10 million per year. And of course, the biennium, simply put, double it. So for a biennium, Multnomah County thinks we're doing our fair share. We're saving the state $20 million. We need to make sure that we're doing that safely for our own community members, and the hydraulics of the program that I've tried to talk fast and summarize are doing the best we can to make sure that that's the case too. But as I've mentioned, we'll know for sure. I'll have a better idea for you as time goes on and be able to report back on those matters. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Representative Wisnett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. District Attorney Hummel, thank you for being here. Thank you for your testimony.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. Hope is safe roads, hope travel. Mr. District Attorney, you know, we're going to have housing shortages and population growth as a norm for Deschutes County. I think you and I many years ago probably worked housing issues in Deschutes County. This 3194 is a tough lift for this body based upon the co-chair's budget. So we're going to need, you know, some good numbers. I have had visit by the courts and by criminal justice and the county commissioners saying it's good, we need it in Deschutes County, it's saving. Taken as a given that the housing and growth is going to increase, is it the adult probation and parole? You indicated some problems in your office taking over new. How are we going to, you know, turn the program around in Deschutes County, as you indicated you'd like to do?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Wisnett. The money for Deschutes County that we're getting in the current year is sufficient. If we were to receive that next year, you know, we'd be fine. It wouldn't be, you know, as good as it could be. I suggested, you know, additional housing money would be wonderful, but if we could maintain the number, we could do well, because the problems in my office are a problem of a leadership, and we'll fix that problem. Parole and probation is doing well. The courts are doing well. The concern in Deschutes County is if the number drops, that's a problem, because even if we keep the number static, you know, Representative, we're struggling in Deschutes County with the need for an additional judge, because we'd like to add a veterans court. We'd like to expand our drug court program. We'd like to expand our mental health program. We can't do that unless we got additional money, but we understand that the constraints here in your budget. So we're asking for at least a hold the line on the JRP program. But if the JRP money slips, then we run into problems.
Thank you. I'll be glad to assist any way possible.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. DA Underhill, I have a question for you. So very impressive information on Multnomah County's effort. The one thing that I'm wondering is, having a rate at 70%, is part of that due to the tools that are available to you in the community? In other words, would a county be able to do similar things, or are there things that Multnomah County has as an urban county that helps support that process?
Great question, Representative Gorsuch, if I may. There's a number of hydraulics that go into answering that question. They begin with commitment. It begins with commitment, I suppose, in my mind. I'm firmly committed, as are other district attorneys. You've heard from several of them, but there are several others as well, firmly committed to make this program work. So it begins there. Add to it the fact that in Multnomah County, we are fortunate to have access to more programs, because I'm going to overly simplify my answer, if I might, for a moment. But one of the things, when I used to day-to-day negotiate cases as part of the first 20 years of my career, one of the things that goes into that equation is, can I keep this individual safely in the community, or am I, going back to Representative Krieger's kind of question, am I going to create a situation where I can predict other crime victims? And who are those other crime victims? They're going to be members of our community. And I don't mean to be overly kind of simple about it, but that's part of the equation. And so when in making that analysis, one of the things that helps a prosecutor to move over to the probation conversation more robustly is knowing that there are programs available that actually work, that we've got sufficiently funded supervision base, meaning the parole and probation officers are plentiful or enough, right, to cover the ground. And that we are closely monitoring them, and that the court system, when we do have somebody who has misstepped, we bring that person back before the court, and that we look at the behavior and we look at a graduated, if appropriate, response. Not the first time that they misstep. Do they need to go back to prison? Is there some adjustment we can do? What that means, sir, is everybody's got to be participating. And we do have the everybody in Multnomah County. We are fortunate. We do have more of those, right? We do have more everybody's and more programs available. So I do get the benefit and reward of seeing some greater opportunities and greater numbers just by sheer volume. I should add that relative to the funding, so that you know, one of the questions was how much did county get? I think Lane County was asked. Multnomah County received $3.165 million. We spent $2.7 million in 1 year. Remember I mentioned that the program began July 1st of 2014. We had a fair amount of kind of getting started. It's a pretty robust program. So we spent 2.7 of the 3.165 in a period of 1 year. Now, we've done a good return on our investment. You see our numbers. While at the same time, I can't say the same thing that D.A. Hummel said, which means the same funding will allow us to continue to do this program, because that's not the case in Multnomah County. Our program, round number-ish, is a closer to a 2.7 per year, not a 2.7 for a biennium. See, I hope I'm making that clear. Because we are in it for the long term. We want to be. But that balance of being able to err on the side of let's give this guy probation instead of prison on those close calls, and there's a darn many of those. When I look at my prosecutors, I say, I want you to err on the side of probation confidently. It's because we have a good safety net of programs out there, supervision-based, you know, probation officers, courts that's involved, all of those other system partners that need to be resourced appropriately and in it philosophically like the rest of us, which is our situation up in Multnomah County.
Thank you.
Any questions?
No question, but I see Mr. Schmidt back there, and you brought up the subject of resource availability, and a part of the discussion that we had with the Subcommittee on Drug Courts was to do a statewide mapping, because recognizing that all counties were not the same, as with when you start talking about resource availability. So I'll kind of yield to CJC as to where we are in that. It was a concern of mine that as we talk about various safety nets and what really does exist in the 36 counties or not. Some of our counties are blessed to have that safety net, and some of those critical programs and others do not. So I just need to put that on the record. And I understand CJC, that was one of the things that we were working on in the drug courts subcommittee.
Well, if there's ever any confusion, CJC has been a wealth and benefit to all of us. And so we appreciate their participation and leadership in this conversation. Right. Senator Bates, can I get you that number for Tim Hartnett, the executive director? All right, I'll work on that and get it to you today.
Thank you.
You bet.
Well, this has been a very good presentation. We really appreciate the great work that's happening and, or will happen in the in the future. I think, you know, we really need to know the unvarnished truth of what's happening there. So I really appreciate everybody coming forward and telling us those stories, Senator Winters.
Mr. Chair, there was a lot of, and I commend, you know, everyone who was at the table to work to make 3194 and its passage in 2013, and there was a lot of work. There was a lot of individuals who actually questioned whether or not it was going to be successful or not. And I just need to say, with CJC and the district attorneys and all of the stakeholders to date, you know, have really rolled up their sleeves and really have tried to find and not only solutions, but to work at talking about reducing the bed capacity as at the same time keeping our community safe. And I, you know, want to thank all of those who've been involved in leading the way for Oregon. And I know my other co-chair over there who was part of this with us, and those, there was some very nice, robust discussions to get us
there. Were, Senator.
So that's
There was.
That's right. We know how busy you guys are. Thank you for coming down to take the time.
Thank you.
This meeting is adjourned.